All right, so please take your Bibles again and turn to Ephesians chapter 5. We are continuing a section in Ephesians that has kind of a long title for a long section, and that is Living Wisely by the Spirit in the Home. And really, that section begins in verse 22, and it extends all the way to chapter 6 and verse 9. So it is quite a lengthy section. We have in the past looked at verse 22, which deals with the responsibilities of the wives living in the home. We're focusing now on verses 25 to 33. We're devoting quite a bit of time to the husband's role, simply because there are many more verses for them. And so again, the idea here is that we are to live wisely by the Spirit in the home. Those who have trusted Christ as Savior are indwelt by the Spirit of God, and they are then enabled by the Spirit to live a life in their home that is glorifying to God. See, the commands that God gives us, we are incapable of following them unless it is by the Spirit of God that we fulfill them. And so that is the idea in this larger section in chapter 5 and verse 18. Paul commanded us to be controlled or filled by the Spirit. And so it is the Spirit of God who enables us to fulfill this passage. And specifically now, as we look at the men, the husbands, and your role within the family unit, you need to recognize that what God is calling you to here is something that is very high, it's lofty, it's unattainable for us in our natural selves. And so therefore we must be controlled by the Spirit in order that we love our wives as Christ loved the church. If you would follow along with me as I read, beginning in verse 25 of chapter 5, Ephesians. Chapter 5, husbands, love your wives just as Christ also loved the church and gave himself for her, that he might sanctify and cleanse her with the washing of water by the word, that he might present her to himself a glorious church, not having spot or wrinkle or any such thing, but that she should be holy and without blemish. So husbands ought to love their own wives as their own bodies. He who loves his wife loves himself. For no one ever hated his own flesh, but nourishes and cherishes it, just as the Lord does the church. For we are members of his body, of his flesh, and of his bones. For this reason a man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to the wife, and the two shall become one flesh. This is a great mystery, but I speak concerning Christ and the church. Nevertheless, let each one of you in particular so love his own wife as himself, and let the wife see that she respects her husband. And so you can see, obviously, the focus of the attention in verses 25 to 33 are on the husband's role within the home. In verse 33, Paul basically summarizes what he has said starting in verse 22, and he addresses again the husbands and wives. And so we're focusing on the third part of our sermon on for the role of the husbands, and we're going to focus our attention beginning in verse 29. Where he says, for no one ever hated his own flesh, but nourishes and cherishes it. We have seen thus far in Paul's instructions to us as husbands that, one, we are to love our wives unconditionally. Just as Christ loved the church unconditionally, so we must love our wives unconditionally. And what that means is that there is nothing that our wives could do which would remove our obligation in loving them. Secondly, we were commanded to love our wives sacrificially. Love our wives sacrificially. Christ loved the church by giving himself up completely for the spiritual benefit of the church. And so we must live selfless lives for the benefit of our wives. And so each day, each moment, our lives are to be characterized by selflessness. And then we saw that we are to love our wives purposefully. Christ loved the church in order to redeem her and to present her faultless. And so we must love our wives with the intent of helping them on a spiritual level, on a physical level, on an emotional level. And then last week we saw that we must, we also saw that we must love our wives increasingly. Just as we were commanded to love our wives as Christ loved the church, that means that that according to chapter 3, verses 14 to 19, that we will love our wives as we grow in our understanding of Christ's love for us. And so the more that we understand experientially about Christ's love, the more we will be able to demonstrate love to our wives. Let me put that a different way. The more we understand of Christ's love, the more we can demonstrate Christ's love to our wives. And then last week we saw that we must love our wives naturally. And that's the section in which we are finding ourselves right now. And so it's a rather larger section. Love your wife naturally. And so we saw in verse 28, Paul said, "So the husbands ought to love their wives as their own bodies. He who loves his wife loves himself." And so the point was in that verse that you are connected to your wife. She is part of you. And so you must love her as part of you. And so it must be natural. As natural as you would love yourself. And so that brings us then to verse 29, which is a continuation of that thought. So in verse 29, Paul said, "For no one ever hated his own flesh, but nourishes it and cherishes it." And so in verse 29, he's trying to get across the idea that you should have a natural concern for your wife. You should have a natural concern for your wife. And he really uses two illustrations to bring, or one illustration to bring this forward. And that first illustration has to do with the natural care of yourselves. He said, "No one ever hated his own flesh, but nourishes it and cherishes it." That we should take that statement as an axiom, as a general rule of life. It's not an absolute, because there are some people who do not take care of themselves. And so last week I pointed out that verse 29 implies that we have a natural love for ourselves. Now, there is a point when self-love becomes wrong. If we love God more, if we love ourselves more than God or more than others, then it is a wrong kind of self-love. But here Paul is not speaking about a wrong kind of self-love. He's talking about a natural love that is not only natural, but it is good and it is right. And he said here, "Love your wives as you, no one ever hated him, his own flesh. No one ever hated his own flesh." And so Paul's idea here is that we should love our wives as ourselves, being part of ourselves. The point, Paul isn't saying here that you should love your wives as you sinfully love yourself or selfishly love yourself. And so the idea is proper love is natural. We have a natural self-love, and there's everything proper about that. And a proper demonstration of self-love is in verse 29, he nourishes and cherishes it. Proper love is demonstrated by nourishing and caring for one's own needs. And so it's natural to care for yourself. You nourish your body. You take care of your body by providing for the things that it needs. And so there's nothing wrong with that. There's everything right with that. The word nourish here connotes the idea of feeding the body. But probably a better word is nurture, because it goes beyond the simple feeding of the body to actually caring for all aspects of the body and the entire being. And the word cherish also carries the idea of caring for oneself. And so Paul's point is that it's natural to love yourself, and as it is natural to love yourself, it ought to be natural to love your own wife. And that is why in verse 28, Paul said, the husband must love their own wives as their own bodies. Your wife is part of you. And therefore, just as it is natural for you to take care of yourself, So you should demonstrate love to your wife by caring for her. And so, you know, we could bring in the idea that your love for yourself is unconditional, isn't it? I mean, you love yourself even though you're not perfect. You love yourself even though you've got some flaws. And so you ought to love your wife in a similar manner, even though she might not be perfect. And you are to love her because she is part of you. And so in verses 29 and 30, we find another idea that Paul brings forward using another illustration. He says in the latter part of verse 29, just as the Lord does the church. So he's linking that to verse 29. No one ever hated his own flesh, but nourishes it and cherishes it, just as the Lord does the church. For we are members of his body, of his flesh, and of his bones. And so the idea there is that you should have a Christ-like concern for your wife. You should have a Christ-like concern for your wife. Now he brings in another illustration, and the illustration is of the Lord Jesus Christ. And now Paul is using the word body and flesh, but he is using it in a metaphorical sense. In verse 28 and 29, the first part, he was using body, flesh in the sense of a literal sense. Now he's speaking metaphorically regarding the body and flesh of Christ. And notice in verse 29, again, it says that the man nourishes and cherishes his own body just as the Lord does the church. And so the Lord is looking after the church. Who is the church? Well, verse 30 says, we are members of his body and of his flesh. And so the idea is that Christ cares not for his physical body, but for his spiritual body, the church. And so Christ is caring for his spiritual body. And the reason for Christ's care for the church is found in verse 30. We are members of his body, of his flesh, and of his bones. Why does Christ care for the church? Because the church is connected to him. Why does Christ care for the church? Because the church is his body. It is part of him. It is united to him. And so it is natural then for Christ to care for the church because it is part of him. He redeemed it through his sacrificial death, chapter 1, verse 7. He sealed it by his Spirit, chapter 1, verse 13. He empowers it through the Spirit, chapter 1, verse 19. He formed it into a body by his Spirit, chapter 2, verse 16. And he continues to fill it with his fullness, chapter 3, verse 19. And he gifts it. And so we can see he purchased it, and he continues to care for it. And so just as Christ continues to care for his spiritual body, the church, so husbands ought to have an ongoing concern for their own wives who have been inseparably linked to them. And so Paul, you can see Paul has stressed the idea of oneness, of unity. He talked about the fact that the church is one with Christ. He also talked about the fact that the wife is one with her husband. So where does he get that idea from? Where is he getting that idea of oneness from? Well, he's getting it from the Old Testament. Not only does he go to the Old Testament to back up what he is saying, but he even goes further. He goes into the very first part of the Old Testament, into the first book of the Old Testament, almost to the first chapter of the first book. He goes to Genesis chapter 2 and verse 24. And that is the quote that we have in verse 31. For this reason, a man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. And so now Paul is quoting Moses. And the context of Moses' words here is in light of creation and the fact that God created man and woman. And so it goes right back to the creation of the world. And that is where he gets the idea of oneness from. The idea that a man and a woman are united together. And so, interestingly, Moses wrote about Adam and Eve, and he talked about the fact that God created Eve from one rib of Adam. And when Adam saw his wife Eve, he said, "Wow, this is now bone of my bone and flesh of my flesh." And Moses summarized by saying, "For this reason, a man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh." You see, Adam and Eve were one because Eve was taken from Adam. However, Moses summarized that this oneness would likewise be shared between all, every husband and wife pair through marriage. And so every man who marries a woman becomes one flesh with her. And so the husband and wife become an inseparable unit. And that is why Jesus said in Matthew 19, verse 6, "What God has joined together, let no man separate." And so Paul's quote here from Genesis 2:24 has general instructions for the marriage relationship. General instructions, but it also informs us regarding the one flesh relationship. But let's look at those instructions very quickly. It says, "For this reason, a man shall leave his father and mother." And so the first step of marriage is that of leaving. The husband, and it is assumed here, the wife, must leave his or her parents behind. That not only indicates a physical departure, but it also indicates a cessation, a ceasing of the previous relationship. No longer is the relationship a mother-father or a parent-child relationship in the sense that they are under the parent's authority. They leave father and mother and they become their own unit, their own family unit. And so before they left the home, both husband and wife were under the authority of their parents. But they leave father and mother, they become their own family unit. The new father in that relationship, the husband, becomes the head of his home. And that is why, one reason why there are sometimes marriage failures. Either the husband or the wife does not recognize and understand that they have left mommy and daddy, or the parents fail to understand that their children have formed a new family unit and therefore they must not interfere. And so there is a new unit, a new family unit that is created here. But secondly, Moses said that the husband would be, notice this, joined to his wife and the two shall become one flesh. The word joined here, suggests a bond. Let me try to illustrate what kind of bond that Moses is speaking about here and that Paul is referencing. You know, in the field of chemistry, you would talk about various different bonds. There is the cohesive bond, which is a bond between on a molecular level. So for instance, a piece of aluminum stays together because its molecules are attracted to one another. And so there are numerous aluminum molecules, and the cohesive bond creates one piece of aluminum. But that's not the kind of bond that Paul is talking about here. It's not the type of bond that Moses is talking about, because they're not suggesting that the husband and wife become one entity and that they lose their personality. So that's not the kind of thing that they're referring to. Now, there is another kind of bond that we could try to illustrate this. It's actually not a good illustration. And that is, if I were to take two pieces of lumber together, and I wanted to join them together, and I took a nail and I drove a nail through both pieces of wood, well, they would be joined together. But you know, I could easily take a crowbar and pry them apart. And that's not what Paul is referring to here either. The closest analogy that I can come to is talking about an adhesive bond. We know what an adhesive is. And the word joined suggests a gluing together. The cement in between two items fastens them so tightly that the two pieces function as one, though they remain their distinct pieces. And so the cement holds so well that if you were to try to pry them apart, the pieces would not release at the joint. You'd actually find that some of the first piece goes with the second piece, and some of the second piece goes with the first piece. And that is the idea here of the marriage bond. Two people who are inseparably joined together. They're glued together. They're functioning as one, even though they retain their distinctive characteristics and personalities. Moses also used the phrase, they shall become one flesh. When they leave their parents and they commit to one another, they're glued together. Though they're two distinct people, they function as one. And so it's not that cohesive bond. It's that adhesive bond where two separate parts become functionally one. And so each person remains a distinct person, but they are, in a sense, enlarged by one another. They're complemented by one another. And it brings together a perfect blending of two separate lives into one. And so when a man makes a public covenant with a woman, and they are joined together through a sexual relationship, God unites these two into an inseparable unit. And that union, the result of that union is, as Paul refers to it here, as oneness. And that oneness is the basis for Paul's command here for the husbands. I mean, when you think about it, Paul is really hammering home that idea of oneness here. Love your wives as yourself. Love your wives because she is part of you. She is inseparably linked to you. And that the truth of this oneness, we find then Paul applies in verse 32 and 33. And he applies it in two different ways. And the first way is a little complicated, because you'll notice it says in verse 31, he talks about the husband-wife relationship from Genesis 2:24, but then in verse 32 he says, this is a great mystery, but I speak concerning Christ and the church. And you scratch your head and think, okay, I know he did talk about Christ and the church, but his primary idea wasn't about Christ and the church. His primary idea was about the husband-wife relationship. So what does Paul all of a sudden mean here? I'm speaking about the church. He was talking about the marriage relationship. Some have mistakenly understood Paul, and they have suggested that the picture of oneness of the husband and wife in Genesis is a picture of Christ's relationship to the church. The problem with that is you'd be hard-pressed to find that idea in Genesis. If you were to go into Genesis 2:24, you would not get the idea that the marriage relationship is a picture of Christ and the church. You'd have to read that back into the text. So let's try and wrestle through this together. First of all, we need to remember in verse 31. In verse 31, Paul has used, he has hinted toward Genesis 2:23, which talks about the creation of Adam and Eve. We saw in verse 28 that the husbands are to love their wives who are part of her husband's body. Then we see in verse 31, that Paul quoted Genesis 2:24 that shows Moses' application of the union of Adam and Eve. In other words, Adam and Eve were united together by God, and Moses' application was that all marriages after that point will be united together into a one flesh relationship through a commitment and a sexual union. And so Paul quotes that text to back up his instruction to us as husbands. He's using that to demonstrate that we are one with our wives, and therefore we must love our wives. So that is the obvious conclusion of verse 31. And Paul, therefore, uses verse 31 to emphasize the idea that he already brought out in verse 28. Husbands, love your wives as your own bodies. Husbands, love your wives because they are part of you. Where does he get that from? He goes to Genesis. All right, so that much is clear. We understand that. Secondly, in verse 32, we need to notice that Paul's quote here comes directly after his comments about the... Notice in verse 31, Paul is quoting here Genesis 2:24, and he says, "For this reason a man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his flesh." But notice his comments come right after what he said in verse 30. "We are members of his body and of his flesh and of his bones. For this reason a man shall leave his father and mother." And so he is in some way connecting the fact that we are connected to Christ with Genesis 2:24. And so we have to figure out the connection. So first of all, how are we going to do that? First of all, notice in verse 32, we have the word mystery. This is a great mystery. We've encountered this word before in Ephesians. You know, in our English language, we use the word mystery in this sense. We use it in the sense of being mysterious. Something that we know takes place, but we just don't understand how it takes place. Mysterious. But that's not how Paul uses the word. The word doesn't mean mysterious. And we saw that when we looked at the word mystery earlier in Ephesians chapter 1 verse 9 and then chapter 3 verse 3 to 9, that the word mystery does not mean mysterious. We learned that the word mystery was referring to something that was hidden in God. It could not be unraveled by man. And then it's finally revealed by God. And so Paul referred to the church as a mystery. And he specifically said it was not revealed to men prior. It was revealed to the New Testament apostles and prophets. And so this mystery, it was hidden in God, but now it is made manifest to us. And the apostles and prophets are declaring that. And so the church is called a mystery. It was not known in the Old Testament. It was revealed by God through the apostles. And that is the idea of a mystery here. Paul is using it in a similar fashion. It's a truth previously hidden, revealed by God. And so, again, some think that this mystery in chapter verse 32 is that of Genesis 2:24. And that is that Genesis 2:24 is really a picture of Christ in the church. That Genesis 2:24 somehow has some deep, hidden meaning behind the actual words. That somehow Genesis 2:24 pictures and predicts Christ and his union with the church. The problem is, again, that the word mystery never refers to a mysterious kind of transaction. If God was trying to predict something, he would give us words that we understood that would actually point man forward. The word mystery follows the idea of union in verse 31. In verse 31, he is talking about the union of man and woman. What was the issue in verse 30? It was the union between Christ and the church. And so the mystery is on the level of two becoming one. In other words, Paul is using Genesis 2:24 as a picture, as an allegory to illustrate the mystery pertaining to Christ and the church. That is, that Christ and His church are united together. That is the mystery. That was not revealed in the Old Testament. That is being revealed in the New Testament. That Christ is one with His church. And so the mystery is not of human marriage. The mystery is of the union between Christ and the church. And so Paul is using Genesis 2:24 to back up his ideas regarding the union of man and wife. But then he is using it as a picture to demonstrate how Christ could be united to His church and how the church can be called His body and His flesh. And so Paul said, "I speak concerning Christ and the church." The husband-wife relationship was revealed in Genesis 2:24 as a one-flesh relationship. But Paul uses that husband-wife relationship to illustrate the spiritual union between Christ and His church. This was a mystery. That was something that did not exist in the Old Testament. And it is new, and it is revealed to us through the New Testament, through the apostles and prophets. So again, on the one hand, Paul is quoting Genesis 2:24 to support his command to us as husbands to tenderly care for our wives who are part of us. And he goes back to Genesis to say, that's where I get that from. From the beginning of time, a man joined to his wife become one. But on the other hand, Paul's quote in Genesis 2:24, he's using it to illustrate something that is a newer concept, and that is the union between Christ and the church. And so as New Testament husbands, we have greater instruction. We have greater responsibility. We, like Old Testament believers, have the argument of a one-flesh relationship. When did that begin? Creation. But as New Testament believers, husbands are given more information regarding their relationship to their wives. And that is that they are to love their wives as Christ loved the church. It's an unconditional love. It's a sacrificial love. It's a purposeful love. It's an increasing love. And it is a natural love. Christ has a natural love for the church because the church has become part of His spiritual body through spiritual union. And therefore, as Christ loves His body, husbands must love their wives to whom they have been inseparably joined together. And therefore, when you love and care for your wife in the same way that Christ loves and cares for His church, you are glorifying Christ. When you love your wife in an unconditional, sacrificial, purposeful manner, you are demonstrating to others what Christ's love for the church is like. And so your love for your wife is a demonstration to unbelievers of what Christ's unconditional love is like. And so by loving your wife in a Christ-like manner, you glorify Him. And so then Paul ends off this section by again addressing all both parties in the marriage relationship, both husbands and wives. And his idea here is to develop Christ-like character in the home. It's a summary statement of all that he has said thus far. Develop Christ-like character in the home. And he says, nevertheless, let each one of you in particular so love his wife as himself, and let the wife see that she respects her husband. And so, again, let me just summarize. How did I get Christ-like character out of that verse? Well, he started off in chapter 5, verse 18, by commanding us to be controlled by the Spirit. One of the evidences of being Spirit-filled is a relationship that is based upon this idea of submission. Notice verse 21, submitting to one another in the fear of God. And so in verses 22 to 33, he talks about the first relationship, human relationship within the home that is characterized by that issue of submission. And that is the marriage relationship. Within marriage, there has to be a clear understanding of who is the leader and who is following that leader. And so, as we saw Paul's description of marriage, it significantly raised the bar. It raised the bar according to the day and age in which they lived, these Ephesian believers. They were used to a more of a Romanized kind of relationship in the home. And Paul said, no, it's not that low. Marriage is much higher than that. And you can see, in fact, that he is even giving us more information that is informing us to a greater degree regarding our husband-wife relationship than existed in the Old Testament. And so the bar is being raised. And so Paul's description of marriage is not one that existed in Rome, was not one that existed in the Old Testament, and probably was not one that you're associated with. It's of a higher ideal. You know, and so we have many people today that, you know, they have a real sour attitude regarding marriage because of what they've experienced. And they're taking all of their thoughts and all of their experiences and they approach a text like this, and they bristle at ideas that there might be some sort of a structure and authority in the home. But when we understand it in context, we understand that this authority in the home is to be a Christ-like authority. One who unconditionally loves his wife. And so Paul summarized his responsibilities to the husband by saying, let each one of you in particular love his own wife as himself, recognizing that she is connected to him. He addressed the wife by saying, let the wife see that she respects her husband. The word respect here, I don't know how else to say this other than to say that the word respect is probably more of a politically correct word. A lot of the translations put the word respect in here. But, you know, I'm going to throw this out, and again, it's going to possibly cause your warning flags to go up. It is the word phobeo. You know, if I've got a phobia, that word we get from the Greek, because the word phobeo means fear. Now, we've seen before that the word phobeo can refer to an abject fear, a cringing dread of judgment, a fear that causes us to run from God. But that's obviously not the kind of fear that Paul is talking about here. The word phobeo is also used in a proper sense regarding the believer's attitude toward God. We are, notice in verse 21, to submit to one another in the fear of God. And so it's not just respect. Because respect, I can respect someone, but it doesn't mean I have to obey them. And that is what Paul is bringing out here with respect to the wives. They are to, verse 22, submit to their husbands. And so the word fear here is not a cringing dread. It's not a fear of disobeying or offending. It's not a fear of harm. But it is a greater than respect. It is the attitude that causes the woman not only a fear of God to submit to her husband, but also a fear of the husband's authority. It is to understand that her husband has a God-given responsibility. And God is working through the husband to lead the family, and therefore she must follow his leadership. All right, so please don't misunderstand. I'm not suggesting that you ought to go home and hide in the closet because you are fearful of your husband. All right, that's not the point at all. Paul is trying to get across that the Christian wives must submit to the husband's leadership. And so that ends a large section on marriage. Specifically, we've been looking at the husband's role within marriage, but he started off by saying, wives, you need to submit to your husbands. And after he gets through those three verses, he spends the rest of the time talking about husbands and their love relationship with their wives, and their relationship with their wives has to be drastically different from what they were learning in their world around them. They need to inform their love relationship with their wives based upon Scripture, whether it be Genesis chapter 2, verse 24, or the example they have of Christ himself. And they are to love their wives as Christ sacrificially loved the church. And so marriage is the union of two individuals into a one flesh relationship. And therefore it should not be a divisive union, but rather a loving and harmonious relationship. But if we can go back to chapter 5, verse 18, we remind ourselves that that kind of relationship is impossible unless both people are living under the control and influence of the Spirit of God. And so we will successfully have Christ-like marriages when we are following the Spirit of God who leads us into obedience of God's Word.